on March 16th, 2012. We have members present, Representative Newman, Representative Costello, Representative Benjamin, Representative Dugan, Co-Chair Thomas Holtz, Vice Chair Faircloth, Representative Guerra, Representative Wilson, Representative Gettenberg, and Representative Jewell. Had I noticed, I would have said everybody was present. We have a quorum to do business. We have three bills before us, House Bill 78, which has been before us on several other iterations. We had questions of the administration. We have them here today, too, also with a letter. We have an updated fiscal note, which we're going to have some discussion on that. And we have House Bill 9. It's intent just to allow the sponsor to present a new committee substitute for future consideration. And then we have House Bill 182. If we get the during the budget process, I think there was a transfer of some information for a committee substitute, and when we were dealing with the operating budget, I think we just got a little distracted. If we can get to that one, we will. We will. If not, we'll take it up the very first thing on Monday, but we'll play that one by ear. That, welcome Representative Heron.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Of course, at the last time we met, the committee had a concern about state residencies, was instructed to, I was instructed to work with the department to craft a letter by the commissioner addressing this issue. It is in your packet, and available to answer any questions on that as well. The second issue, I'd just like to, while I have the floor here, sir, is that there was a question or a concern by my colleague, Representative Guerra, about the primary care physicians. And I think what this legislation does is that it creates an environment with all these occupations that support and enhance primary care throughout the state. So, you know, this legislation would have the commissioner establish priorities for incentive loan programs for eligible sites. But the key thing is that this legislation would address specifically that concern. Is we want to create an environment that supports primary care physicians to make it more attractive for primary care physicians to come. Plus, all these other occupations are critical to primary care for the residents of the state.
And I'd also, I'd like to have the department go on record and address those. We've spent a lot of time talking in committee, so put your comments on the record as well.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Jill Lewis. I'm Deputy Director with the Division of Public Health. And I would just say that the administration agrees with what Representative Heron has said.
I kind of like you guys to say it. No, seriously, yeah, that's about that. There were some, we've had a lot of dialogue on the residency issues, and there were reasons that Commissioner Strewer and others in the department had for that you needed the flexibility. I would really like you to put that on the record.
Certainly. I'm sorry, I'm just a little bit nervous this morning.
We're a very friendly group. It's just a couple guys over here.
Just donuts.
And I haven't had my coffee.
Chairman, I've had a donut, so.
And those were compliments of Pete Feldman of the Alaska Farm Bureau for his ringing cell phone, so please keep yours turned off. No texting and no iPad work in the committee.
Thank you, please. Chair.
Did that calm you down?
A little bit. In reference to the questions about the residency, we believe that the current committee substitute gives us the latitude and the ability to address residency in the regulatory process. And we would be willing to look at that.
That's probably the best.
Is that?
That's fine. That'll be fine.
Okay.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I appreciate Representative Heron's statement of intent, which is this is really geared towards, well, it's most primarily geared towards primary care physicians, which where we have the most shortage. Would the department agree with that as well?
Yes, the occupations and the provider types are primary care types for the most part. I would agree with the chair.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? We'll go on to the, why don't you just stay up there? We'll go on to the fiscal note. You may have some comments. And I'm going to represent Fairclough. Our fiscal note, Czar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would point the committee to a fiscal note, the 2765. It's from Health and Human Services. The allocation line is Health Planning and Systems Development. It's dated 3/16/2012. It was just passed out. The difference you'll find is on page 3, and it has to do with the amendment that we incorporated the last time this bill was before us that moved the nurse practitioners Tier 2 to Tier 1. And that is a pending item before the Board of Nursing, and so that fiscal note would be implemented if the Board of Nursing adopts a regulation that requires the ANPs to complete the degree of doctoral nurse practice.
And that's a categorization, not a retirement status.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I would note that the fiscal note would come from payments for practitioners that will be paid from the service line.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who can answer the question. What can one in the nurse practitioner, what can they do with a doctoral if they can't, if they don't have it, and how much difference is their cost for education?
Ms. Clements is jumping the bit there.
Thank you very much. Through the chair, Representative Wilson.
Please, I identified you, but we do have a protocol here.
Thank you very much, Chair Stoltz. For the record, my name is Liz Clement, proud staff to Representative Bob Herron. The Doctor of Nursing Practice, actually, there's a national move right now. Many states are looking at, potentially by the year 2015, of moving to require their advanced nurse practitioners to hold a DNP, Doctor of Nursing Practice. Currently, in the state of Alaska, we have some master's level nurse practitioners as well as some doctorate level nurse practitioners. If I may, we've had correspondence with the Board of Nursing. Currently, they are not planning on moving to the DNP requirement by 2015. However, they may in the future. So if I may clarify, the amendment that was added in at the last meeting just creates space for that to happen potentially in the future. As far as the scope of practice goes, I believe there is actually not a difference in the services they may provide. It's just the level of education that may be required to advance in the future.
Does an ANP have to work under a doctor, though, to do the prescriptions and so forth? In a collaborative agreement?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson and Representative Stoltz, I would refer that question to others who are here in the room representing the advanced nurse practitioners.
No, everyone I've seen has always been in a doctor's office. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that they're in a collaborative agreement. You know, they're less expensive to hire and more available and do a lot of the same things. If you go in, you need bronchitis or a lot of the things, the flu, and that's where I've certainly seen most of them. Anyway, that's really not critical to us moving past this out, but we can, Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, for the committee, in FY13, there's $2,842,900 in FY13. That amount is reduced from the commodities line by $7,600 for future years. So in FY14, the total amount allocated in years out reflected on this fiscal note, 2014 through FY 2018, is $2,835,300. I would note, as in previous fiscal notes, that there's only one full-time person that's hired, and this is mostly for loan reimbursements as far as the program goes, and I'd like a confirmation from the Department of Health that only one person is.
Ms. Lewis?
For the chair, to Representative Fairclough, that's correct. There would just be one employee hired.
Any questions? Representative Dugan.
On the fiscal note, Mr. Chairman, could you give me, can you tell me why the estimate is 90 participants in the first year, what that's based on?
Yes, Pat. Ms. Lewis or Pat Carr?
I'll take a stab at it, and if I don't have a sufficient answer, we'll ask Pat to come up and join us. Through the chair, Representative Dugan, I believe the bill says that the maximum we may have is 90 participants, and our hope would be that we could actually attract 90 participants.
Representative Dugan.
So the number, this is the maximum, the actual amount could be lower?
Through the chair, that's true. Yes, the amount could be lower.
And the, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. So the amount that is lower is going to come directly back to the state. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, if I understand your question, if you're asking if we do not, in fact, get 90 people in the first year, then we would not need to spend all the money that was given to us in the fiscal note, and that money would come back to the state.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions on the fiscal note? Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on Representative Dugan's question, when grants are issued from a nonprofit perspective, because that's the experience that I can reflect on, a lot of the spend down is done in the fourth quarter because people don't want to lose money for programs. And so you see a lot of activity in fourth quarter where people are either truing up through auditing or whatever is happening. If we look at our grants, sometimes we see more spending in the third quarter because they've had time. In the first quarter, they haven't been able to ramp up their programs. And so are we building in, since it's an operating budget item, the possibility that if you don't spend it down, that someone in the future might try to reduce it? And so for that reason, you might broaden the regulations to allow more people easier entry to not accomplish the goal that we're trying to do. I think that's my concern, is we're setting out an amount of money that we really don't know how many people will apply for, and then sometimes people don't remember that programs take a while to ramp up, and so then there might be an issue about coming back in. Anyway, your thoughts on an operating budget item versus a grant for a similar amount?
Through the chair, Representative Fairclough, if I understand your question, we would follow, but we don't expect to expand in the regulations on what has been set out in the bill to try and encourage broader participation than what the intent is of this bill. And it is true that it might take us a little time to ramp up. And that kind of goes to the comment for Representative Dugan that if that was to happen, then, you know, our plan would be that we would return those funds to the state. And I'm not sure I addressed all of your question.
Okay. Any other questions on that? Any amendments? Madam Vice Chair.
Chairman, I move from committee the CS for House Bill 78 Finance 27-LS0147/O dated 3/1/12 with attached fiscal notes. I believe there are two, and individual committee recommendations.
Any objections? Hearing none, the bill is moved committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes. We'll take a very brief at ease. House Finance come back to order. It's 25 to 10 or 9:35. And we have our next bill up, House Bill 9. We have a new iteration of a committee substitute. Just for the record, the intent is just to have this again on the table so that folks can look at it. There's still public process ahead of us on this bill. It is scheduled again for Tuesday. It'll be the first of the hearings on it. We still have to do with public process and our due diligence here in committee. So with that, Mr. Wright and Ms. Delbridge.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just briefly.
Representative Garrett.
I know I missed a little bit of that hearing the other day, but the member from AHFC stated that he wasn't prepared fully for questions, so we'll be able to talk to AHFC also during the subsequent hearings. So.
Is that Mr. Dubler?
Or somebody?
Mr. Chairman, just so you know, online is Joe Dubler from AGDC. Also in appearance today are Mara Carlson Van Dort from DEC, also Ruth Hesse, who is with the Department of Law representing DEC, John Hutchins from the Department of Law, and online Martin Schultz, Department of Law for DNR, in case there's any questions about any of the changes that are made within the CS.
Let's present the CS, and I think the intent of the sponsor was to let members have over the weekend and several days to look at it before the next hearing. Is that correct assessment?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. We just wanted to give members ample time to look this over, come up with questions, and at the next hearing try to answer questions that will be before the committee when the bill is presented again.
Let's see. 316, yeah, this would be the right thing. We'll go ahead and move the CS. I'll object to it so we can discuss it and hopefully adopt it and move on. Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I move before the committee the CS for House Bill 9, Finance 27-LS075-K, Bullock 316, 2012.
I'll object.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tom Wright. I'm staff to Speaker Chenault. And there were several changes incorporated into the CS. Most of these were suggestions on behalf of the Department of Law, DNR, and DEC. And I can go over these really briefly. You also have a summary of changes in front of you today that also explains what has been incorporated into the CS. There is a title change in the CS, Mr. Chairman. Page 1, line 6, after lease, it adds an action or decision related to. This is the title change is due to the language that's been adopted in the body of the bill. Page 1, line 8, after corporation, adds a successor or a successor in interest. Going over the substantive changes within the bill, Mr. Chairman, page 2, line 8 through page 3, line 5, we've added a new section of legislative findings and intent. The reason why these were placed within the bill is just to clarify that this is what we're trying to do with this legislation. Page 2, lines 11 through 15, incorporates a letter of intent related to disclosure of operating agreements, which is found within the body of House Bill 9. This intent language clarifies so that an executed operating agreement will be disclosed publicly to the extent that disclosure doesn't divulge trade secrets or other proprietary business information. Page 2, line 16 through page 3, line 5, is the rest of the intent language, which adds finding an intent related to AGDC's mission, direction to provide gas and to ship gas at commercially reasonable rates, makes a determination of an AGDC project as being within the public convenience and necessity, also declares development of an in-state gas pipeline is in the best interest of the state, and finds that the state will have a policy of making state royalty gas available for shipment in an AGDC pipeline. Sections 2 and 3 are renumbered because of the new intent section that's found within the bill, the new Section 1. In Section 4, which is the old Section 3, page 6, lines 20 through 28, this sets parameters on the direction for state agencies to give AGDC access to information. AGDC, once again, just for the members' information, is the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. Gives them access to information directly related to an in-state natural gas pipeline. If the agency finds that information to be transferred to AGDC as confidential, the agency may require a confidentiality agreement and if a third party's rights are affected, AGDC has to secure the third party's consent before receiving that information. This was recommended by the Department of Law, and again, is intended to set parameters around the information that's to be shared between state agencies and AGDC. Some information held by state agencies is confidential and cannot automatically be shared with AGDC. Section 5, again, it's a renumbering. Section 6, page 7, line 10, we've changed the term at no cost or rental fee to at no appraisal or rental cost. And this terminology was recommended by the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office and better reflects existing terminology. Section 7, the changes found are page 8, lines 15 through 16, and it adds after rates, except as provided in C of the section. This again conforms to the change found in Section 6, which clarifies that non-hydrocarbon natural resources of the state are to be made available to AGDC at usual and customary rates, and a state right-of-way lease will be granted at no appraisal or rental cost. Also on page 8, lines 25 through 28, we added a new subsection I, and this clarifies that a state right-of-way lease entered into by AGDC may be transferred to a successor under the same terms the lease is granted to AGDC. Sections 8, 9, 10, 11 are all renumbered. Section 12, I don't think it's necessary to go over the renumbered section, so I'll refrain from doing that anymore, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, please refrain.
Thank you. Page 13, line 18, after notwithstanding A, we removed and B. And on page 13, line 19, replaced cost to or reimbursement by with appraisal or rental cost to. And again, both these changes were recommended by the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office. The SPCO, the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office, operates on receipt authority, and AGDC does need to pay those services. So the term appraisal or rental cost conforms, again, to the State Pipeline Coordinator Office terminology. Removal of the B, again, just allows them to collect receipts from AGDC for any work that they happen to do for the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. Page 14, section 13, page 14, line 13, added or authorization after decision, and on the next line, 14 through 15, after under, replaced authority delegated to with a program approved or delegated by. And both these changes address technical concerns by the Department of Environmental Conservation. This is to allow them to oversee those programs that normally might be overseen by EPA. And again, we have Ruth Hesse and Van Dorn Carlson here to answer questions if you have them regarding this section. Section 17, lines 16 through 18, we've inserted a pledge under the subsection shall be treated as a disposal of gas other than by sale or exchange for purposes of AS3805183. This is to bring the royalty in kind or the royalty gas section into what DNR believes conformity with other sections that they have. And the rest are all renumbering changes, Mr. Chairman. So those basically are the changes that have been adopted within the CS.
I just have a question. You mentioned royalty gas a couple times. And how? So the state owns roughly one out of every eight units of natural gas. How do you sell just one out of eight units and not the others without producing the other seven-eighths? How does that work?
This is, for the record, Rena Delbridge, staff to Representative Hawker. Representative Garrett, through the chair, this simply says that the state's royalty gas would be made available for shipment in this pipeline. It doesn't say that there wouldn't be other gas also involved. So there's no it hasn't come to our attention that there would not be that other gas.
Just through the chair, so I understand. The state gets a royalty on, you know, one-eighth of the value of the hydrocarbon product when it's commercialized. So don't the other seven-eighths have to be sold at the same time for there to be royalty gas?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, I believe that in order to have royalty gas taken as royalty gas in kind, that you would, in fact, need other production. If we have additional questions on the particular nature of royalty gas, I would ask that DNR come up and address those.
We can address that at the next hearing, Mr. Chair. I'm happy.
I suspect shipping commitments, as always, is a pretty essential agreement or ingredient to this. So that'd be my supposition, but we'll get to that fleshed out, too. You can build a pipeline without shipping commitments, and we've got a pipeline, right?
We have no pipeline.
Yeah. You have a piece of steel. Any other? Representative Costello.
Thank you, through the chair. So my question has to do with the change to Section 1 related to the policy, where it says that the state shall have a policy of making our royalty. I mean, essentially how I read that is that we are saying that through this project we are taking our royalty in kind. So is that how I should understand that portion, that change?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Costello, yes, there would be a policy, but that's for gas that's not already committed as well. There might be some gas that's committed for whatever reason. Any gas not committed, we would like the state to be able to use it for consumers and for any commercial enterprises that may end up as one of the end result or users at the end on the end result.
Through the chair.
So
when we talk about the physics of natural gas versus oil, it's my understanding that the size of the pipe really doesn't matter. It doesn't have the same constraints as you would with oil. And so my question has to do with, under this legislation, is it possible for the state to invest in making the line a 48-inch line and then pursuing an owner interest in under a GIA? Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I think I would ask Joe Dubler to respond to that one.
Mr. Dubler, would you care to take a bite at that one, or do you want to defer it to somebody else?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Joe Dubler, Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of AGDC. And also, I'm with me here, Dan Falke, who is the President of AGDC. Through the Chair, Representative Costello, a 48-inch line, if we were to build one from the North Slope to South Central along the corridor that we propose, that certainly is a feasible project. Whether it's commercially feasible or not is another issue altogether. But if the state wanted to fund through a general fund appropriation, the difference between the 2-foot line, which we feel we can fill completely, and a 4-foot line to account for future expansion, that's something that we definitely could do with this project. At this time, it would be a little difficult. We're quite a ways along in the permitting process. But once we reach a certain point, there are modifications you can make to permits that we've received. So that is an option that's available to the state. It's always an option that's available if the state wanted to fund it. But as far as getting the commercial entities that we anticipate coming in to this project to ship gas, to the extent we can't fill up that 48-inch line, we wouldn't be able to recover those costs. So and that's the purpose that the state would have to fund it. We wouldn't be able to recover it in the form of a tariff.
Thank you.
Jim here.
Thank you. Mr. Dubler, I guess I misunderstood this. I thought this bill was left AGIA intact, and AGIA has the provision that says you can't ship more than a half a BCF of gas a day, so that would not allow for a 48-inch pipeline. Isn't that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, that is correct, but I believe Representative Costello's question addressed making this a 48-inch line under the AGIA law, and maybe I misunderstood.
Okay.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On Section 12, it adds a new section, or subsection C, and can somebody tell me what's going on here?
I read it like four times. And
the appraisal rental.
Right.
Ms. Gilbridge.
Representative Dugan, through the chair, are we talking about the appraisal and rental costs?
Yeah. What it seems to say is that, so I don't know where the right-of-way lease comes from.
Ms. Garbage, why don't you just tell us what that means?
Yeah, thank you.
You bet. The right-of-way lease is a lease agreement entered into by AGDC and the Department of Natural Resources. The State Pipeline Coordinator's Office interfaces with this. The SPCO, or State Pipeline Coordinator's Office, is charged with I guess, administering the terms of that lease. The original intent within the legislation was that a state agency needed to provide permits and leases to AGDC at no cost, because that is a cost that would be rolled into the tariff, and in a line that the state's determined is in the interest of the public, that's a cost that may not need to be in the tariff and can keep tariffs lower for people getting gas in Alaska. Thank you. What we've done is SPCO works a little bit differently than your usual state agency and the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office. Thank you, sir.
If you mess up an A there, it'd be a different dog there.
Yeah. There we go. The State Pipeline Coordinator's Office operates on RISI authority, and therefore they very much need that entities that they administer leases for pay into having that administration done. We believe, the sponsors believe, that it was appropriate in that instance to make sure that AGDC is, in fact, paying the costs required for administration of these leases. And if that is not sufficient, we do have Ann Brown online from the SPCO.
I asked you if you wanted Ms. Brown to augment your testimony.
I certainly appreciate it.
Ms. Brown, are you still online?
This is Ann Brown with the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office. I am online.
All right. Did you hear the questions? Most people would like to repeat it, I'm sure.
The question regards the way the SPCO tracks funding and billing for the pipeline project. The benefit of the change that's been proposed is it gives us flexibility as project changes. We have received authority, and we can change very easily to match the needs of the lessee for what they're doing if their activity changed. And all the state agencies working on the project bill through us through reimbursable services agreement. We have no objection. We want to keep the billing system because it's much easier to manage. But we have no objection if they want to add something in the legislation to allow them to not have that as part of the tariff. But for tracking costs and to allow us flexibility in responding to needs and allowing other agencies to respond to us to needs such as fishing game, DEC, and others, the setup we have has worked very smoothly, and is a lot less effort on everybody's part in terms of planning and going to the legislature for funding. We go for receipt authority. That helps.
Yeah, and stay online, please. Representative Wilson, then Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question on page 2, line 18, where it says making natural gas available to Fairbanks. What we've heard from our community is that Dunbar would still make it available to Fairbanks, and I understand the whole concept. We have to have somebody to buy the gas, because why would you put it in Fairbanks if no one was going to buy it? I guess being from that community, we know we need gas and at the most affordable rate. Is there any way, although I know this is just a framework, that this could be a little tighter where, you know, we can have those at Fairbanks realize that it is the intent for this, you know, lateral to be paid as a statewide project, not as something that the residents or whoever on gas will be footing the bill.
And before you answer that, I'd like to know what the definition of Fairbanks is. Is it Fairbanks North Star Borough? Is it the city of Fairbanks? Does that need any clarification?
Representative Wilson, through the chair and to the chair, the definition that we see as Fairbanks is Fairbanks as a population center. An area like South Central has a large population center. We see Fairbanks as a large population center. If someone believes that needs more precise articulation, that's absolutely fine, and we can look into that.
I'm pretty simple. I got confused a little bit, but who knows?
And, Mr. Chairman, I think in response to Representative Wilson's question, again, I would defer to Joe Dubler because they're the AGDC, Alaska Gaslight Development Corporation, was the one who, developed the models for tariffs and the lateral lines, the plans and engineering. So I would defer to Mr. Dubler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair to Representative Wilson, the tariff that was proposed to Fairbanks in our report dated July 1 included the lateral line as part of it, because that's part of the transmission system that gets the gas to Fairbanks. So that would be included as in the tariff. It wouldn't be an additional charge on top of the tariff. As far as distribution lines within the community of Fairbanks, the charge of the Gas Line Corporation was to deliver gas to Fairbanks, and I guess the distribution lines, we didn't interpret the laws as meaning to include distribution lines. So we did not include any distribution networks in our costs. So I hope that answers your question. If not, I'd be happy to expand.
And Mr. Chair, we do realize that distribution lines would be our responsibility. I guess as long as Alaska Gas Line Development, if you're the ones doing the project, I don't think anybody has that issue. The issue's been risen. Let's say that a private corporation comes in and actually builds it after we get all the permitting and everything done, and they decide it's not affordable by their numbers. All of a sudden, Fairbanks gets left off because now the numbers don't come out. And I guess that's really the reason for the more defined, as long as one entity, the one we're working with, has that authority, we're pretty secure. The question is, though, we know that this could be sold and a gas company could come in and build this and control it. If hands change, we want to make sure we're still taken care of just for that lateral, not for the other part.
Thank you.
Certainly, through the chair, Representative Wilson, the issue, I guess, is the cost of the incremental pipe to get the gas from the main line into Fairbanks and that relatively short line and relatively small line would be relatively inexpensive for the number of people that are there, so that if it was a commercial entity that took over from us, first of all, I think they'd have to comply with the lease to the state, which includes that in it, but it just as a commercial basis, I believe there's sufficient use in the Fairbanks area that they would build that line. And again, that's an opinion, but I'm pretty confident that a commercial entity is looking out for their bottom line, and to the extent they can make money, which I'm very confident with the size of the pipe and the length of the pipe, they would be able to do that. So I'm not sure how to put that in this legislation, but I'm pretty confident it would happen.
Thank you.
I may be able to add some clarification if I could. Representative Wilson, through the chair, there's nothing in House Bill 9 that would preclude commercial interests from coming in and doing this on their own anyway, now or at any point. However, this legislation, by providing greater structure to AGDC, allows AGDC to actually, should that occur, look at someone else's project and consider lines from that may accomplish their mission in getting gas to population centers in the interior and in South Central. So there is also that aspect of protection in the sense that we're not precluding anyone else from doing a line outside of this bill, and that they now would be enabled to, I guess, participate, if you would, in such a project.
Okay. Representative Newman and then Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question would be for Ms. Brown with the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office. A couple of questions. Ms. Brown, with the exclusive license that the state has with TransCanada, does this allow, or would there have to be changes to that exclusive license to allow the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation or other producers that might partner with the development corporation to come underneath the fold of the exclusive license? Did there have to be changes to that license for all of these to join together, these pipeline projects?
Well, I think that's a better question for an attorney. Right now, the project is designed so that it does not conflict with the AGEA project, the TransCanada project. If they were to come together, I think the license part would have to be dealt with by the attorneys. In terms of amending the lease for AGDC, and adapting it to changes they want for a combined project, that's something we could easily do through the SPCO. We can do amendments to our lease.
Representative Newman.
There was certain, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Brown, there was certain inducements that were entitled to companies that participated in the first open season with TransCanada's proposal and now Exxon. If there was an alignment between all pipelines, would those same inducements follow through? So because with the exclusive license, it talked about a pipeline specifically from Prudhoe Bay to Canada, the size of the line, the number of components, gas delivered, volumes. That seems to me it would have to change if we were to have alignment to, say, a 24 or 32-inch line to South Central if they were to partner with Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. So any, again, the inducements that were specifically allowed under AGEA, would they, those inducements be have to be upheld with other pipelines in the state if they're willing to come together on them?
I'm afraid I'm the wrong person to answer the detailed questions on the inducement because I'm not that familiar with the AGEA. I'm familiar with their application for the pipeline, but not the statute on regarding inducements. That would be Department of Revenue or Department of Law. What I can say is that if they come together, whether it's under the APP project or the APDC project, both projects through our office, for the applications for the project or the lease for the project can be amended. And we don't see that as a problem. In terms of the specific AGEA constraints, I'm not qualified to answer that.
We do have those folks on. I know they're monitoring this bill from the Department of Revenue. If they're not, I'd be disappointed.
Mr.
So,
Chairman.
But I would like them to come back with those answers for the Newman.
Mr. Chairman, we would be happy to ask someone to be available to the committee at a future hearing to talk specifically about the terms of AGEA and what an aligned project may or may not look like. At that point, I don't believe.
My gentle admonition wasn't enough.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
this is Dan Fowski with Alaska Gas Line. May I respond back to Representative Wilson's question?
Only if you can remind us what that question was.
Certainly, sir. Her question had to do with the fact of the tariff schedule and the insurance of gas for Fairbanks. And I wanted maybe give her some comfort level in that. In the tariffs that we developed, the 60 million feet of gas that we anticipated for the entire Fairbanks region is essential to maintain low tariffs for everyone up and down the line. So there'd be no inducement on our part or desire to not have that gas going in because it would simply drive costs up for others. So Fairbanks is essential in the overall production and development of an affordable tariff schedule for all the citizens that will be utilizing the line.
Thank you. We have Representative Edgeman next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back to the intent language. And intent language is what it is. It's, of course, non-binding advisory language. I'm just trying to, in my attempt to better understand some of the mechanics of the bill. There's a couple of terms in there. One, lowest rate possible, that refers to Fairbanks, South Central, and other communities in Alaska. And there's another term there that's called commercially reasonable that applies to public utilities and industrial customers. Given that RCA wouldn't be involved, as I understand it, in setting or behind those terms, is that going to be the sole authority of AGDC to ensure that the intent of this bill is met vis-a-vis lowest rate possible and commercially reasonable rates?
Representative Edgeman, through the chair, yes, AGDC has this charge to provide commercially reasonable service. And that is the backstop that indicates that AGDC minus a commercially reasonable project doesn't have a project. They also are charged with making sure that the rates that go to communities, public utilities, industrial users, are as low as they can be. And that's where we get into some of the other provisions we've talked about, where we don't want to roll anything more into these tariffs than we have to. And therefore, state support in sand, water, and gravel, for example, becomes really important. I understand what you said about the legislative findings being advisory. However, AGDC does also have that obligation written into its duties under House Bill 369 and also within its, sorry, now Section 2 of the bill. Page 3A and B, right, both in their direction to start getting gas to communities and upon commencement of a main distribution line to start looking at ways to get that to other areas of the state, again, at commercially reasonable rates.
As a follow-up then, commercially reasonable, is that a legal term or, you know, because commercial rates seemingly would also suffice as well. But I understand the reasonable nature because you've got to have some sideboards, but those sideboards, in terms of the reasonable part of commercially, are attached to House Bill 369. Did I get that correctly?
Representative Edgman, through the chair, you're correct. I don't believe commercially reasonable is defined anywhere, and we can certainly look at that.
And as a follow-up, how about lowest rates possible? That seems to be open-ended as well. And, you know, of course, it's on its face what it means, lowest rate possible. It's pretty...
Well, and if I can respond to that, Mr. Chairman, one of the missions of House Bill 369 was in the most economic manner. I think, you know, we're following those guidelines, you know, with the lowest, you know, possible rates, figuring in, you know, cost, you know, cost of building a line, you know, interest, you know, everything else associated with building that line. We still want them to look at the lowest rate possible with all considerations when they deliver this gas to consumers.
That gets language for legitimate aspirations, too. But that's not just a...
Mr. Chairman, this is Joe Duber. Could I respond to Representative Edgman as well? Through the chair, Representative Edgman, the important thing to keep in mind with this project is it will not go forward without a successful open season, and the market will be what determines what commercially reasonable rates and what lowest possible rates are. If the tariffs that we come up with through our engineering projections of costs and financing costs and everything rolled into a tariff comes up with a tariff that's too high, the market will tell us we don't want your project and it won't happen. That's the check and balance that the legislature should take comfort in, and that's that we won't be building a project that sits empty because we won't continue with the project unless we've got full firm shipping commitments for the full capacity of the line.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that, and I think this sort of draws a circle complete for me. That's I wasn't trying to be antagonistic. I was just trying to get a better and fuller understanding. Thank you.
Dave, Representative Guttenberg. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill grants AGDC considerable amount of rights and privileges to build this line. Eminent domain, ability to bond, priority treatment from state agencies, free sand and gravel. But part of the bill and the process is eventuality if another commercial interest comes in, and that's referred to as a successor of interest. If somebody else comes in, do those privileges that the state is giving to AGDC continue with them? Would they have the right of eminent domain if they took over this project for and the ability to bond and those other things that were mentioned? Do those transfer to those as a successor of interest? And if it does, how long do they have that? Is it in place for the existence of the construction of the project or for the life of the project?
Mr. Chairman, we have the Department of Law who can probably answer that. But, again, any lease that's transferred still has to be signed out by the Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources.
Mr. Schultz, are you online?
Yes, this is Martin Schultz. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I am online.
Okay. Were you online enough to hear the question?
Yes, I was, Mr. Chairman. And that is my understanding of that right-of-way provision, is that it could be transferred to a successor in interest. But the way the bill is written, the DNR commissioner would need to approve the transfer of that right-of-way lease.
And what about the bonding authority and the eminent domain? I think that was the more serious question. Is that your question?
I would be happy to address those.
Well, both of you can. Mr. Schultz and then Delbridge.
I believe that those are powers of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation under the bill. And so those particular powers that you just mentioned would remain with the corporation.
Okay. That comforts me on that part. Ms. Delbridge, I hope you too.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe that Mr. Schultz answered that.
Okay. Next, we have, did you have a follow-up?
No, I think that we'll explore that later.
Okay. Representative Guttenberg and then Gara, and we'll stop it there for today.
We'll discuss
Dugan and Gary, I'm sorry. We look alike.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering if there are any estimates of the cost of the spurs to, for instance, rural hubs.
Representative Dugan, through the chair, there are no plans for spurs to rural hubs at this point. The direction is in this bill for AGDC to begin analyzing whether or not those would in fact provide a commercially reasonable gas to those communities after construction starts on this main line that those connecting lines, if you would need to run from. AGDC may be able to give you a more thorough response.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the Chair, Representative Dugan, on page 4, line 5 through line 17, is the direction to AGDC to begin looking for additional natural gas pipelines connecting to industrial, residential, or utility customers in other regions of the state once we begin construction of this line. And the purpose of waiting until we begin construction of the line was to get the project underway and not stop now and let's start looking where else we should be shipping gas. The cost of those lines to other areas, there's a lot of factors that go into the cost of connecting to a natural gas pipeline. The first and probably largest component of it would be the composition of the gas that's going through the line. To the extent it's an enriched stream, which was our initial plan, the cost is fairly prohibitive for smaller communities because we would have to put what's called a straddle plant at every location. Those run, our current estimates are between $250 and $300 million per plant. To the extent that the line was not an enriched stream but a utility-grade gas stream, the cost would be much, much lower, approximately $150,000 per T. And it sounds pretty simple, like you go to, hot tap something you get from Lowe's and clamp it onto the pipe. But it's about $150,000 to run a pipe from the main line, because it's 2,500 PSI, it's a significant valve structure you have to put in. But from there, you just have to run the tube to wherever you want it to be. If it was relatively close to the big line, it would be relatively cheaper. Some of the mines that are further away, however, the cost of the power that they're generating now would definitely make sense for them to tap into this line. So, it depends on the amount of gas you're going to need, because that determines the size of the pipe and whether you need to go with steel or a smaller line. You could go with a plastic pipe. It would be a lot cheaper.
Mr. Chairman.
Jim Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dubler, I understand this might be difficult, but if it was easy, I could sit here and do it myself. Surely you must have at least some initial estimates of what this is going to cost. But frankly, if we're talking about bringing gas to, Dillingham, for instance, we've got to have a better idea of what that cost would be. simply because... otherwise, we're buying a pig in a poke by even accepting this. And You know, I have other concerns about this particular bill, but that's a big one. You know, if we're basing our idea that we're just going to run a pipe from the North Slope to wherever it's going to go, Nikiski, I think, is what the proposal is, that's probably an estimate that we can make relatively well and right now. But these other things, we got to have a better idea of what I've got to have a better idea of what it is that I'm voting on before I vote on it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll take a crack at answering that. The main charge for AGDC established in House Bill 369 was to look at a main line or a bullet line, not to spend a lot of money and a lot of time engineering or trying to do cost estimates to other regions of the state at this point. Again, there is a provision that Mr. Dubler spoke of on page 4. It starts with line 5. Upon commencement of construction, they are to start looking at other areas of the state. But the main purpose of 369, which was, you know, supported by both bodies and signed by the governor, was to look at the main construction first. You know, it does take time. It does take engineering. It does take funds to do these other lines and estimates, you know, that you're looking for. But first and foremost, their duty was to build the main line first, with getting gas in a lateral to Fairbanks and, you know, connecting to a system to Tidewater was the original language.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't mean to turn this into some sort of argument, but this bill here is the one that we're writing. That's what we're doing here. And if we want to put a provision in here that there's going to be an estimate of the cost to the hubs, we can do that. What I'm asking is if there's a way to do that intelligently at this point.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to argue with Representative Dugan. I mean, that is the legislature's prerogative. If they would like, if someone would like to insert language in there, we'll certainly consider it. But again, you know, I have to go back to the main charge that was given to AGDC.
We'll go to Representative Guerra and then Thomas to close.
Just quickly for the next hearing, Ms. Delbridge, Mr. Fauske, and to whoever this is relevant to, we passed HB 369 last session. We put $200 million into a fund for studies and other work. Can somebody give us a detailed description of what we've passed so far, and then in light of that, why we need this? Because when those bills were presented to us, I wasn't envisioning that it would be followed the next year by a bill like this. So I don't want a 10,000-foot description. I want somebody to please go through us for us in detail what we've done so far, what we've spent so far, what's been done with the $200 million that we've put in the fund, and then in light of what we've done in the past, why we need this.
And, Mr. Chairman, I can answer that. The $200 million is still sitting in a fund because the in-state gas line fund has not yet been established.
Representative Guerra, we'd be happy to provide that information to you working with AGDC.
That would be great at the next hearing.
All right. And we'll set this aside. People will further examine the I'm going to remove my objection to the CS. Is there further objection? What a great vice chair. Hearing none, the CS is adopted, and for your review, consideration, critique, et cetera. Further, it will come up again on Tuesday, along with public testimony as well for folks that are.
As long as there's no more CSs.
Yeah, Representative Thomas has said he had always wanted to be on the Resources Committee. This is the next best thing.
Mr. Chairman, I can tell you we had 15 amendments and resources rather than adopting a CS, so I think the CS process is a lot cleaner.
Thank you.
Representative Johansson, well, thank you for also being here, Representative Thompson, and enjoying some of our Farm Bureau donuts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the bill.
You reached me on the last one?
No, this one, yeah.
Thank you. Welcome, Representative. We have the CS before us. It's dated today. We usually like to get these things ahead of time, but we have this little budget project we've been working on. I think we've got it. So Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I move before the body the CS for House Bill 182, Finance 27-LS0573-R, Kirsch, dated 3/16/2012.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, the CS is before us. Welcome, Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for hearing this legislation. My name is Kyle Johansson, representative for House District 1 here in the State House. And basically what House Bill 182 does is it takes all of the requirements in statute that have been written in for the past 40 or 50 years that require departments to print, publish, and distribute actual pamphlets and annual reports and things such as that. No doubt each and every one of you have received every single day annual reports upon annual reports over and over and over again. And that was the initial idea with this bill. It was as introduced and limited to the annual reports. When we got to the State Affairs Committee, the State Affairs Committee decided that they wanted to expand it to all reports that are required by statute to be distributed electronically. And there are exemptions. The commissioner, what I wanted to do is have one person in each department that you could go to if annual reports look like they're out of control. So the commissioner would make a determination whether or not an annual report or an other report would be distributed and printed and published, and wanted to give somebody the opportunity to say yes or no, but the default would be electronically. Every single report that you receive by law has a notice in it that says why it was printed, and it references the statute, and it tells you how much money it costs to print these reports. Most all of them also say this report is available online at www, et cetera, et cetera. If you look in the House Journal, we get those reports almost every single day. So that's what the bill does. That was the concept, and I put it out there at the mercy of the committee process to form it, whatever it comes up with. But just very quickly, the reason that this idea came to me when I sat on the Commerce Subcommittee, a person in Commerce came up with a $250,000 increment. And ask, why do you need the increment? And they said, because printing costs have gone up, and you require that we print all of these reports and send them out. And that didn't seem like it was right. They basically said, it's your fault, and this is an attempt to fix that. Just two quick things. In the 2011 information from OMB, they predicted around $1.6, $1.7 million saving. The latest fiscal note puts it at $350,000 in the analysis section. They've called it indeterminate. I just don't think they know how much they spend on these annual reports, therefore they don't know how much they're going to save, but I think the concept is valid, and I offer that to the committee. The municipality of Anchorage approached me with language to put in the CS, and if we want to take that up at another time or today, we can.
Well, I'd like to hear from them while they're waiting. So we'll defer questions to the sponsor. We'll go right to the public testimony. We have B. Ennis from the Municipality of Anchorage. Which why don't we go to questions, and then we'll have 30, and we'll come back. Is if you have a problem, we'll come back on Monday or Tuesday. I'd like to have the Muni on record, and Representative Costello and then Guerra.
Thank you, through the chair. This is really more of an editorial comment. I did notice that when we passed out the Arctic Policy Council legislation, that the fiscal note in that bill included the costs of printing reports. And so I'm wondering if just sort of as a matter of habit, when fiscal notes are prepared, departments assume that these reports are wanted in a printed format. And so I was just wondering, you know, I was looking at this bill, and I really think it's a great idea, and it goes in a great direction. And perhaps in the future, or maybe now, it will actually include more, for example, boards and commissions and councils that we set up. I do understand that there are certain exemptions and reasons to print reports, but I have files and files of reports, and then I have to decide, am I going to ship them back to Anchorage during the interim if I need them there or what have you, and I think that the cost savings that this bill will result in is something that we all appreciate. So I want to thank the sponsor for bringing this forward.
The default position is it's going to be electronic, but if you have a justifiable reason, if you're going to a major presentation, it might be the article call it submission where you want to have the graphic display that would allow them to do that. No?
That's correct, and that's why the giving the commissioner the ultimate authority to make that decision. If a division director comes and says this is extremely important that we do this, we have somebody we can come back to and say, hey, justify your decision.
I believe we have Ms. Anderson and Ms. Cloud Anchorage back online. Even if it's a Friday, let's go and take her right now. Ms. Ennis, are you still there?
Yes. And do you hear me?
Yeah, loud and clear. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record and your comments.
My name is Deidre Ennis. I'm the Deputy Municipal Attorney for the Municipality of Anchorage, and we are testifying in support of this bill. The municipal language referenced earlier actually speaks to noticing requirements to taxpayers of certain and foreclosure and redemption period. It's very important to note that this bill does not eliminate mail requirements. Taxpayers continue to receive any required notices that must be mailed, but instead, House Bill 182 allows the municipality to substitute or add electronic notice to the newspaper cost, or to the newspaper notice, excuse me. There are three significant benefits to the bill. The first is cost. The one a week for 4 week cost of just the foreclosure list alone is about $20,000. A second significant benefit is updating and flexibility. The foreclosure newspaper publication file must be extracted, that's an IT term of art apparently, about 15 days ahead of the publication date. In the meantime, the taxpayers who do make their payments are not reflected in that list. The newspapers also have a significant lead time by which we have to get this information to them. And as the committee might not be surprised, taxpayers often procrastinate to the very last day to make these payments, and they find themselves on this 1,600-person foreclosure list in the public paper. Many of them could be taken off if we had a more expeditious process. We can provide a lot more information on such a website. The newspaper, the goal of the newspaper is to be as brief as possible due to the expense. The goal of the website is to be helpful. There can be links, there can be procedures, there can be telephone numbers, much more helpful. This overall bill allows a municipality to determine the most effective method to reach its taxpayers, and oftentimes that will have a newspaper component, but it won't be required this four-week process. So the municipality wholeheartedly supports House Bill 182. And for the record, the municipality moved in 2009. We've eliminated much of our publication requirements for as much legislation as we can. Estimated savings were $500,000 the first year. So significant cost savings. Flexibility and ability to update, which saves everybody time and money.
One less payment to Sacramento, California, right?
Yeah.
Any question?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Benjamin.
In other words, what we're hearing is that you're not able to do that in law. The present statutory construct doesn't give you that flexibility to do that?
Not in the last 15 days. Because we have to get that information to the newspaper so far ahead of time, and just because of the IT function of getting that, it's called an extract to the newspaper. So for 15 days, we have a severe limitations on updating.
Thank you.
Just for record, I'd like to send my payment, both of them, on June 15th. The less often I deal with government, the better. So, any other questions? Are there any, I don't see any problem if there's a will to, the fiscal note. We have an amendment.
Mr. Chair, it could be pretty quick. I believe the sponsor is okay with it.
Is it to the most recent version?
It actually magically was to the prior version, but all the lines are the same, so it fits to the most recent version.
Okay. So, to move your amendment.
Sure, I move amendment number one, Mr. Chair.
I'll object for discussion.
Thank you. The sponsor and I have worked on this, and we've worked with the Department of Law to make sure the language is correct. It's all consistent with the bill. I thought I was brilliant, and I came up with this bill, and I realized that Kyle had already written it. So, but there are a couple changes, so let's go through them in order. The first one is a lot of agencies produce reports not because the statute requires them to, but they produce them, right? There's not a statute that requires every report. So what this says is it applies to reports that are produced and distributed because there isn't a statute that requires every report. So that's really just a technical change, but to allow the bill to apply to all reports the agencies produce. The second one on page 4, lines 1 through 2, we want the departments to do their reports electronically as much as possible as the sponsor wants. But the existing language in the bill says that stuff has to be removed within 1 year off the website. There are reports that people will want to see for longer than 1 year, and this just gives the agency the discretion to leave it on their website if they feel like it'll serve the public's interest. So an example would be, I used a fishing stream report that I downloaded that was written 10 years ago at the Department of Fish and Game. It was on their website. It was great. So if they want to take stuff off, that's fine, but don't make them take it off within 1 year. And then the most important part is starting at page 4. We want to save money by telling agencies for those annual reports, and this just applies to annual reports, people who write annual reports get very sort of pride-driven by them. They like them to be fancy. But there's no need for color at times. So, and there's no need for them to hire outside graphics consultants and outside photographers. So this says, unless it's needed, the report shall not be in color. And unless it's needed, agency employees shall do the graphics and photography rather than hiring outside.
You could have done this in black and white for us earlier.
Somehow we got a color.
I can pass it up, Representative Garrett.
Lead by example.
So that part will just save a lot of money.
Chairman, I just wanted to know if the sponsor is okay with the amendment.
To the chair, Madam Vice Chair, yes, we've worked on this amendment together. I didn't see anything on its face that was troublesome, but I'm open to suggestions. But I think they're good suggestions to improve the bill. Thank you.
I have a question, Representative Johansson and Garrett. I don't think there's any cost for storing this on the Internet, really. I guess why not for at least a year? And that's presumed that you're not going to delete it, because I know there's a lot of value going back and checking records. It deletes that. Okay.
Right. Under the bill right now, they have to take it down.
Okay, you've already appealed. Excuse me, I didn't read that carefully. No. All right. Is there any objection to the amendment?
I'll remove my objection.
Hearing none, the amendment stopped it. We've already talked about the fiscal note, the impermanent nature. I'd like to move it out if there's less. Oh, Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair, I just had a question as for the bill. I want to see savings in government, obviously, but not everybody has access to Internet, and I think that lack of information, especially government information, is not a good thing when people want to be involved and want to have that. Does this provide for an opt-out on this? So if somebody wanted to be able to get paper documentation of what's going on this, that they can do that?
Call the representative.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, on page 4, two-part answer, page 4, lines 13 and 14, A person may obtain a print copy of the report from the State Library Distribution and Data Access Center. I was unaware that this center even existed until we had this bill in front of State Affairs. We had the librarian, the state librarian, come and testify extensively about how they do this all the time anyway. This does not change the fact that copies of every single state document will still be copied on paper and kept at the state library as we do for archival purposes. They already have a distribution center, and they assure me and the State Affairs Committee that they would have no problem, and they do this every day for people that do not have access currently to the internet and request documents. So I felt very good about that. Again, part two, the commissioner has the authority to deem whether or not a document is so important that it should be distributed, and they would have to make that determination.
Mr. Chair, I understand that this goes to the State Library, and I think the State Library is in Juneau here, the State Library Distribution System. I'm not sure if it goes through all the borough libraries, but there's a lot of people in a lot of communities that don't have those libraries. And I just think the lack of information that people may want to get is an issue, and if people would like to receive a paper copy, they should be allowed to be able to get that. And instead of just automatically the government saying, we're going to give it electronically, tough. You know, if somebody wants to get it in a paper, but I don't see anything in here that allows that to opt in to say, I want paper copies.
Yeah, I'd be surprised, you know, sometimes you do the flip side. The 90,000 people in the Massu Borough, where you and I represent, I bet you more than 1,000 people have computers. I doubt if with communications publication, the Mets, the Frontiersman has 1,000 paid subscriptions. And those are just generalizations, but you know, it's.
Am I? This was a concern brought up when I first introduced the bill by my state my librarian in Ketchikan. And so we wrote the bill specifically to make sure that the Library Distribution Center, who the state library is connected to each and every library across the state, and I can certainly provide the testimony from the librarian to you that would be extremely comfortable. Also, a legislative research report that is in the backup indicates that nearly 86% of households are in an area that are available to receive internet access, and that was in that's in the latest report that's in your backup from 2011. But I felt comfortable enough with the options for people who you're talking about, and I think it's crafted in a way that we can get those reports to those people.
We're on general bill discussion. Is there an objection maintained to the amendment?
I remove my objection.
Hearing none, that's adopted, and I'd like to formally close the public hearing process. I think we just had the one. I'd like you, before, if you and Reed can put together maybe what the average circulations are of some of our newspapers, that might help us on the floor discussion. I was just taking a wild guess at what WIC Communications, the Arizona company, was for the Matsu Borough and the McClatchy out of Sacramento. They can.
There's much less circulation at the Daily News than there used to be.
Yeah, for sure. It may be helpful in the discussion. And so, Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move from committee the CS for House Bill Number 182, Finance 27-LS0573/R. Dated 3/16 from committee, as amended, with attached fiscal note and individual committee recommendations.
Yeah, please stay around and sign the report. And I guess we've missed the pledge and the prayer by now that we'll join the session. So we will not convene today at 1:30. So you recall what time on Monday we were 1:30. We weren't doing a morning meeting. 1:30 on Monday. We don't have a morning meeting scheduled.
Yep. Yeah. That was quite quick.